News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea behind the show, the reason we call it Hometown Heroes, is that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or small your hometown might be, I guarantee you there are men and women in that town who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. They are heroes. And in the case of our World War II generation, our greatest generation, they have some great stories many times that haven't been told. So we like to tell them on this show, preserve those stories for posterity. Hope the veterans feel the honor and reverence that we have for their service and sacrifice, and maybe along the way learn a thing or two. And I'm often asked how I find people to be on this show, and I always say, well, I don't find them, they find me. People give me some great recommendations. And in the case today, our friend Chuck Poochigian, who you might remember from the state Senate or now at the 5th District Court of Appeals, he told me a couple years ago, you got to talk to this guy, Mike Lombardi. He's got some great stories. So he's been on my list for a while, and I'm glad to have him here today. He is one pretty special character. I think a lot of people would like to hit one hole-in-one in their life, let alone six, or bowl one 300 game, let alone a dozen. And who in the world could hit a hole-in-one and bowl a 300 game in the same day? Well, our guest today, Mike Lombardi, can claim that. We'll get to that a little later. But, Mike, let's start out a little earlier than that. You're growing up in Denver, Colorado, an Italian-American family, obviously. And I'm guessing that you remember December 7th, 1941, and how you found out America had been attacked. What do you remember about that day?
I was in Boulder, Colorado, University of Colorado, and heard it come over the radio. And it was shocking news. Couldn't believe anything like that could happen.
So you're an 18-year-old college freshman.
I was a 17-year-old college freshman.
And did it hit you that you're about the age that Uncle Sam might want a piece of you here now that America's at war?
Yes, it did. But then on Monday, the university president called a convocation and advised no one to rush off and enlist, to go in an orderly manner, that things would be worked out and would be told what to do. So we waited. Later on, I was in the athletic department. I was in college on a track scholarship. And 40 of us athletes decided we didn't want to live in the mud and dirt and cold. So we enlisted in the Air Force, so we could fly, come back, and have someplace warm to sleep and good food to eat. So we went down and enlisted then.
So you wanted to stay out of the infantry?
Correct.
And you enlisted in the Air Corps. Were you thinking you might be flying airplanes? Was that one of your aims?
I enlisted solely to fly, and took the test. They give you an examination. It's got three parts: pilot, navigator, and bombardier. I was going through engineering school, and so it was fairly easy tests. And I got 100 on each. And they asked me if I'd like to be a navigator. I says, no, I enlisted to be a pilot. They says, well, we need navigators. I says, yeah, but I got 100 on the pilot portion. They says, yes, but not too many get 100 on the navigator portion. We need navigators, but we'll think about it. And when the orders come out 4 days later, guess what? I went to navigation school.
Yeah, you weren't making the decision, unfortunately. You know, I think that's the first time I've heard it just like that. Cause I've talked to a lot of guys who joined the Air Corps hoping to be pilots, and many times they didn't get the score they needed to continue. But you're telling me you got a perfect score, could have continued, but because of the need for navigators, they didn't allow you to pursue that dream. So you end up in navigational school, and we're going to hear a little bit later on about the special souvenir that Mike brought with him to the interview today. You can see a picture of it online at kmjnow.com. It's a powerful reminder of his days as a navigator on a B-17. But when you start this training to be a navigator, was it challenging? Did it come naturally to you? What was maybe the biggest hurdle you had to overcome to actually get those wings and be a navigator on a B-17 crew?
Actually, with the background, It was fairly simple. The only thing that was difficult is when you were in a plane, you were supposed to what they called swing the compass to find out if the readings were good. And to do that, find a straight road and fly down the road and look down this drift meter, which they called, and look at the road and see what the headings were. And if that didn't make you sick, nothing in the world would. And that was the only really tough part of the whole training.
Mm-hmm. It seems a little disorienting, just how you describe it. Did it take you a while to get used to being up in the sky and orienting yourself and being able to read the instruments and know where you were going?
No, it seemed to come natural. It was when you're young like that and something you hadn't done, you're very interested and you just take to it.
So it was about 3 months after Pearl Harbor that you enlisted in the Air Corps. How long was it before you actually had a crew and you were shipping overseas to get into some action? I ask you because I know you've got the dates written down in your little black book there.
I left for England aboard a ship on April 25th of 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And got to England on May 6th. Went to a couple of different places in London, but arrived at the base that I was going to serve from at Ridgewell, England, on my birthday, May 26th, 1944. That's when I arrived at the 381st Bomb Group.
And what we know now, that was about 10 days before the invasion of mainland Europe
Yes.
began with the D-Day attacks on Normandy, June 6th. So it's your birthday, you're in England, you've got all these young guys around you. Did you have a little celebration, or were you too distracted by the task at hand to enjoy that birthday?
Nobody knew it was my birthday, so you didn't. And everybody had too much on their mind to worry about some young kid's birthday. That was the least thing they worried about.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I'm curious. So a lot of time has passed here. It's more than 2 years since you joined the service, and now you're finally going to get into some action. Were you looking forward to that with anticipation? Had you been kind of frustrated when you see the war going on in the Pacific and other parts of the world and you're not part of it? Or were you saying, you know what, I'll wait as long as they want me to?
Going through training all this time,
mm-hmm.
there was a tremendous amount of training. They used to, the one exercise to make sure you knew where you were going, there used to be three student navigators aboard a plane, and you couldn't see out of the plane. The only thing you could see is the compass and the airspeed.
Hope you're not claustrophobic in that situation.
No. And the pilot would fly to three different points, and one student would navigate, tell the pilot how to get to point A, and the other two would follow, not knowing where the first one was going. They would just follow and find out where he went. When you got to point A, the second one took over and told the pilot how to get to point B. The others followed, and then when you got to point B, the third one told him how to get back to the home base. And if you did it right, luckily you got back to home base. If you goofed off somewhere, who knows where you ended up. And a couple of times we got lost. It was interesting, but the pilot always had the map out in front of him, and he knew the territory real well that we were flying over, so he could always get us home anyway.
I'm sure there are a lot of amusing moments in the course of all that training. And I'm guessing that as you got to England in late May of 44, by that time you had formed some relationships and you had an idea of the crew that you hoped to be flying missions with?
Yes, we met, we went over on a ship. There was a few Air Force crews, and there was field artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really exciting because the colonel in charge of the field artillery unit, he didn't know how Air Force units worked. He was very, very adamant against the enlisted men playing cards with us. Usually the whole crew would get together and play cards. And he said that was fraternizing, so he broke all the sergeants down to buck privates. But that didn't sit too well with the colonel when we got to the 381st Bomb Group. So he gave them all their rank back plus one promotion. He said no paddle foot was going to break his men.
So the poker games were back on after that.
Yeah, because the crew has to work together. You know,
yeah.
You're aboard that plane, and if somebody goofs up, the whole 10 of you go down. It's great that you do get along. You have to get along. Otherwise, you can't really make it.
And if an officer needs an enlisted man to save his life, he's not going to deny him just because he's an enlisted man.
That's right. And the officer is not going to not help the enlisted man. You're going to help each other as much as possible.
So I want to talk to you about your first mission in a moment, but a little bit more about this crew before we get to that. And that first mission would be very eventful, and that's a story in its own right. But so you've got this crew, 10 men on the crew for a B-17.
Yes.
You're the navigator.
Yes.
What did you understand that to mean? What did you expect to be doing over the course of a mission? And do you think your expectation matched reality?
On the combat missions, the navigator in the lead plane, he did the navigation.
Mm-hmm.
He told the pilot where to go, and the rest of the group followed. The other navigators, one in each plane, followed, because in case you lost an engine or something went wrong and you fell behind, you had to know where you were and how to get back.
Sure.
So you had to know where you were at all the times, and that was your job, to keep track of where you were at all times so you could get back home.
Did you feel, because of that, that those other 9 men on the plane, that their lives depended on you and your ability to do your job right?
Yes. And twice, we went home one time with one engine, and we started at 34,000 feet. A B-17 cannot maintain altitude, and it slowly descends. We made the English coast, but luckily we got to the base.
Just barely. Well, I know we've got 33 missions of yours to cover here, or at least the highlights of those 33 missions. Before we dive into that, I'm curious. A lot of guys that I've talked to who were in England before D-Day remember hearing Eisenhower's speech to all the soldiers and naval personnel and airmen before Operation Overlord began. Do you remember hearing that? Do you remember hearing Ike's voice?
I was not there at that time when he gave that big talk.
So at your base, it wasn't broadcast or anything like that.
No.
Did you realize on June 6th that something had happened and something had started and
yes.
You guys just missed out on it?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
The crews were called in, the ones that were going to fly that day, they were called in about 4 o'clock in the morning
mm-hmm.
to get ready. And that's when everybody knows that something's going on. You don't know where unless you go to briefing. That's the only time the destination is divulged. And that's when we knew something was happening, because all the planes, the ground crews were telling how they were loading all these bombs, different types of bombs. And being they were going to bomb the front lines where most of the Germans were, there were a whole bunch of anti-personnel bombs, which were ones that are full of shrapnel, which are designed just to kill people.
Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of bombs you'd be armed with the next day on June 7th when you flew your first mission.
Right.
Was there any sense of disappointment among your crew that you didn't get to fly on that first day of this gigantic invasion that the world had never seen before?
No, I don't. You know, it's hard to remember, but I don't think so.
I'm sure everything that happened after that gave you more than your fill of action. Well, we're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to get into these 33 missions that Mike Lombardi flew as a navigator on a B-17 with the 534th Bomb Squadron of the 381st Bomb Group. We're going to talk about some very eventful missions and a very special souvenir that'll be a family treasure for years to come. And just one look at it will tell you there's a powerful story behind it. We're going to get that story from Mike Lombardi when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and I have 3 words for you. Ready? Duration Premium Cool. Duration Premium Cool roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing come with state-of-the-art reflective granules that lower the amount of solar energy entering your home. That means your AC may not have to work so hard, resulting in an energy bill that will go the only direction you ever want it to go, down. I did it. You can too. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool at a Pacific Supply location near you. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and Advanced Placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships, and now one of its football coaches is former All-Pro quarterback Daryl LaMonica. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you haven't been to KMJNow.com yet to see this photo, you better head over there and look at the souvenir that Mike Lombardi brought with him from his B-17 Navigator days. Take one look at it and you'll know what I'm talking about. We're going to get the story of that in just a little bit. Mike is 88 years old now, but you wouldn't know it from his handshake, which is as strong as any I've encountered in quite a while. He still plays golf several times a week and, in fact, shot a 90, a lot better than I can do, the last time he played 18 holes just this week. He's got an extensive athletic history that includes winning the Colorado State High School Championship in the 880 way back when. He would go back to school after the war and run track at the University of Colorado again. But we're talking about his time with the 381st Bomb Group in World War II. And I want to talk about this first mission. It's the second day of the war in France, at least from an American perspective, June 7th, 1944. And you didn't expect to be flying. This was a bit of a surprise. Tell me how that all unfolded.
Well, the navigator on one of the crews got sick, so they needed one. And I was the first one, I guess, they came to when they came in to wake somebody up. So I got the call. So I went, and like I said, I had no idea where we were going, nothing. They just told me, get on board and follow, and that's all I did.
And you, I'm sure, knew none of these men, a 10-man crew, didn't know any of them.
Didn't know anybody aboard at all.
So whatever safety net you thought you might have in terms of knowing some people and having an idea of what you're doing, you're just, for lack of a better analogy, you're flying blind on your first mission.
That's correct.
Well, and I'm sure it only got better from there.
From there, I flew with my own crew.
Well, let's talk about this first mission, because the way that mission unfolded wasn't a whole barrel of fun either.
No, I mean, hanging in the bomb bay, chopping bombs away with an axe was not...
So let's get that story. You guys, your target was Kurland, and you're headed to the target, and you get to the target, and the bombs won't release?
Yeah, when the lead plane releases his bombs, all the other bombardiers in the group hit the salvo switch, and all the bombs drop. So it's a pattern. Well, the bombardier hit the salvo switch, didn't release, and we couldn't land with them because the arming pins were exposed, so we had to get rid of them, so we had to go chop them out and let them drop.
Since they were already armed, if you had tried to land, you would have just killed everybody aboard and probably some people on the ground.
Right.
So you had to get rid of these bombs.
Right.
And of all the 10 guys on board, they chose you to take a hatchet down to the bomb bay?
Well, the navigator's the nose. The others are all in the back of the plane.
Right. So describe for our listeners, and I've been inside of a B-17, not in the air, but on the ground, and I know what you're talking about, but for people who've never been inside a B-17, describe what that bomb bay is like and the contortions that you had to go through just to stand there and not go out with the bomb.
Well, the bomb bay, it has one little channel right through the center. about 6 inches wide, which goes from the front to the back. And that's how you get to the front of the plane and back of the plane. It has a hatch in the nose, which you could jump up and get in, but it's easier to get in the waist door and walk across. The bomb bay doors open. There's one on each side of this pathway, and each bomb drops each side. And had to hang on to the rigging inside and chop away.
So your feet are on basically what amounts to a balance beam.
Right.
And you're how high in the air?
We were about 14,000 feet.
So one wrong step, and you're out there.
And you go swimming in the bay.
Or if you end up straddling the thing, that wouldn't feel very good either.
Oh, that.
And meanwhile, you've got a hatchet in your hand, and you're hacking away at metal.
Right.
Next to a live bomb.
Right.
So did that seem like the longest assignment of your career, or what?
It seemed like you make no headway until the thing finally broke loose. It just seemed to break loose at one shot, which was great because you're hitting it, you can't see anything happening, and finally it's gone.
But it wasn't over then. So you get one of them, and it's gone, but then it lands in the English Channel, and this is June 7th, 1944. The English Channel is full of Allied warships.
And they all turned their guns toward us. They thought they were being bombed. And the pilot dives down and hits the deck, so the guns aboard a ship will not lower that far. And so that's how we got rid of the second bomb then.
So your very first mission, you don't know where you're going. You've never worked with these guys before. You have to go hack off these bombs to get them to drop. And then your own forces want to shoot you out of the sky. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever think during that time, what in the world did I get myself into and I'm never going to make it home today?
No, you really never really thought about it. It's just something that had to be done, you did it.
So once you got down low enough where the guns couldn't get you, you're able to get that other bomb off of there and yeah. It falls harmlessly in the water and you make it home. Do you remember what it was like to get home from that mission? Was that the biggest sigh of relief or what?
Oh, yeah, it really felt good when you see the home base, when you see that control tower, because that was one of the things later on, all the crews that weren't flying, when it was time for the planes to come back, they used to stand out there to count them and see if they all made it. It was a sad sight when you'd count and they were short. They didn't all make it back.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you realized that someone you had gotten to know, maybe with another crew, maybe a guy that you had served with yourself, didn't make it back and had become a casualty of this war?
It was about the third mission when got back to the barracks and they were rolling up the mattresses. There were three crews in a barracks and they were rolling up the mattresses. And when they start that, you know that they're not coming back. They were, radio message came in that the thing went down in flames, and when someone sees it go down in flames, told that they go clean everything up before everybody gets back.
Mm-hmm. How did that hit you, to know that some people doing the same thing as you had just died?
It's terrible. It's hard to explain, but it just feels really, real bad to see those, you know, that they were there yesterday and today they're gone.
Does it make you ask yourself, what if I'm next?
No. Well, I never wanted to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's healthy to think about things like that. Just let things happen as they do, and after it's over with, don't dwell on what happened. You keep thinking about it, you drive yourself nuts.
So I guess if that was your mentality, that first mission didn't bother you all that much and didn't make you question whether you should show up for mission number two?
You didn't have a choice.
Very true. And you didn't have to wait long because you were back in the air the very next day.
Yeah, we went on the 8th, and then the next one was on the 10th. The next one was on the 12th, and then the 14th. So it was quite steady. Sometimes you didn't go two in a row because the plane had received damage due to the anti-aircraft flak, and they'd have to repair the plane, so the crew never went into a different plane. They always waited for their own plane. So if it had to be repaired, you waited until it was repaired.
And after flying that first mission with a crew you were completely unfamiliar with, Did you eventually get back to the crew that you had come over with and trained with?
Oh, the next mission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first crew never saw again.
How much better did that feel to be with guys that you actually knew?
Well, you knew because you knew who they were, you talked to them, you played cards with them, you know, it's comfortable.
It's a little easier to entrust your life to someone you know. Well, the 33 missions that you were part of with the 534th Bomb Squadron of the 381st Bomb Group, 33 missions from June 7th to August 26th. That's a pretty short time span, just a few months to get all those missions in. So literally, you were flying almost every day for quite a stretch there. How often would you say you guys did encounter flak? How often were you hearing that telltale sign and seeing stuff flying and getting home with holes in your B-17?
Every mission.
Every single mission.
Every mission. Because the Germans were very good with those 88s. They come on, they'd reach 35,000 feet.
Mm.
And we always just say, as long as you could just see the smoke, don't worry about it. But when you see the red in that smoke, it's too damn close.
Mm-hmm. As a navigator, I think people who maybe aren't too familiar with it say, well, if he's a navigator, he gets to decide where that plane is going. And
no.
You don't have that kind of control.
You have no control at all because you got a mission from your home base to point A, and that's where you're going. And the route has been decided, and you're going to go that way no matter what.
And if you see flak coming up ahead, all your choice is to just fly through it,
just
right?
Just go right through it. The only time you get to deviate any is for weather. And if the weather changed severely enough that you couldn't get through to the target, then we had maps, and you'd hit what they called a target of opportunity. You'd pick out some place that you could see from the air and go drop your load on them.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, if you got hit, if your plane was shot up on virtually every mission, then this came to be a pretty routine thing for you, or at least something you expected. When you got close to a moment where you knew that flak was going to be riddling your aircraft, was there anything that you discovered that would help you prepare for that, or anything you did mentally to just be ready for those kind of circumstances?
There was really nothing you could do. You just sit there and hope it's not close enough that it gets you. Because the planes had an awful lot of flak holes in them. And you're up there, and the temperature is right around 65 below. And that cold air is whistling in, and they couldn't plug all the holes. The larger ones they did patch, but the rest of them, they just left. And you had that nice cool breeze coming in all the time.
A frozen breeze would be more like it. I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand either, that the technology was not what it is today.
No.
And you guys needed heated flight suits just to be able to function.
Well, the heated flight suits, you had a choice, what they called the electric suit and the sheepskin.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want the electric suit because if one hand or glove went out, all four of them went, both hands, both feet.
Mm.
And then they froze, and they had to take them off, take your feet off. And so where's the sheepskin? It wasn't as warm, but at least you didn't get the frostbite.
I hear you. And you also had the option of putting on a flak helmet. Is that something you did on every mission?
Every mission, I did. I always wore it. I thank God I did.
I can see why, because I'm looking at it right now, and it has a very unique alteration to that flak helmet, kind of right on top of the right side of your head and right next to that hole, which is about, I guess, 3 inches wide and, well, 3 inches long and an inch wide would be a better way of putting it. And you can see a picture of this online at kmjnow.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Right next to that hole, it says Berlin, 21 June. So this is just 2 weeks into the war in France from an American perspective. 21st of June, 1944, you're on a mission. What do you remember about that mission? What do you remember happening, and why is that date written next to that hole on your helmet?
Well, the date is written because that's when the hole was formed. But that was the first time Berlin was hit.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that the defense was going to be really strong because that was their capital. That's where everything's at. And it was a fighter plane came right in head on to us and firing his machine gun. And that's what hit me, was a machine gun bullet, a 50 caliber shell.
Did you have any idea this was about to happen?
Well, he's coming in firing. You could see it. Then that's the end of the story until I looked out and saw the English coast. I took the helmet off and I could see through the top. Then I started feeling my head to see if it was all there. Everything was fine there, but over my head where the thing exploded, there was shrapnel holes through the top of the plane. So I was lucky everything went up. Just my lucky day.
So a shell from a German fighter plane, probably an ME-109, I'm guessing.
Right.
Came right through, hits you right in the helmet, leaves that hole in your helmet, but doesn't leave a scratch on you?
I had one little mark on my forehead, but it didn't draw blood. It was just a red mark where the helmet pushed back far enough. I probably got a concussion out of it, but they didn't think it was severe enough to put me in the hospital or anything because I flew the next 3 days.
Uh-huh. But this did knock you unconscious for hours, right?
About 3 hours.
And this helmet is something to look at now, and I encourage all of you to go online at kmjnow.com and get a look. And I'm sure it's been the source of a lot of stories with your daughters and granddaughters, and now you have a couple great-granddaughters over the years and will be for years to come. But I'm curious what you remember about coming to. And did they have to tell you what happened? Did you remember what happened? And what was that moment like to figure out that you were really okay?
Well, the last thing I remembered was the fighter plane coming in at the nose. And the navigator has a machine gun out of each side of the nose. I was at one firing, and that's the last thing I remember.
So you were firing at him while he's firing at you.
Yeah.
He gets you, he knocks you out, and the next thing you know, you're coming to and see that hole in your helmet, and you can see through the helmet. And were you amazed that you had survived that?
Absolutely. Because you see a hole like that, you're feeling your head, thinking you're going to find blood, but I didn't.
And I don't want to overstate it, but is it fair to say that not only did you realize you could have been dead, but you kind of felt like you should have been dead?
Well, I never felt that way, that I should have been, but I knew it could have been.
But when you see a helmet, like a hole like that in that spot in the helmet, it doesn't give you a lot of optimism about the guy wearing the helmet.
That's right.
So you have a lot to be thankful for.
Yes, I do.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. Right now, we need to take another commercial break. When we come back, that was only mission number 10 for Mike Lombardi. Of the 33 that he flew as a navigator in a B-17 squadron with the 381st Bomb Group, we'll have more of his stories when Hometown Heroes continues next. It's News Talk 580 KMJ. Rising energy bills got you down? Paul Leffler here telling you to look up. As in, look up to the top of your house and put your roof to work for your wallet. I want to tell you about Duration Premium Cool, the Energy Star rated roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing and Asphalt. I don't have to tell you how hot California summers can get, but did you know that installing a cool roof can help fend off that heat? You can take your pick from four distinctive colors. We have sage on top of the Leffler home, but what makes Duration Premium Cool shingles so special is the reflective granule technology that basically bounces sunlight back up to the sky so it doesn't get absorbed into your home. Duration Premium Cool shingles are proven to reflect up to 25% of that solar energy targeting your house on a hot summer day. So you may not have to use your AC as much, potentially giving your air conditioner a rest. So don't just get any roof, get an energy-efficient cool roof from Owens Corning. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool shingles at a Pacific Supply location near you.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to come down the home stretch now with Mike Lombardi of Fresno, California. He's 88 years old. Maybe you've seen him around. Maybe you play golf with him at Kings River Country Club, or maybe you're a bowler and you remember when he was president of the California State Bowling Association. Or you were there for one of his 300 games, or you know that he is in the Central California Bowling Hall of Fame. None of that would have happened if he didn't make it home from World War II, and he's already told us about his closest call. He has the helmet here to prove it. You can see that at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. A helmet with a big old hole in it from the round that hit him in the head and knocked him unconscious back in June of 1944. But as he told us, he was flying the next 2 days in a row. So it kind of sounds like, Mike, that whole experience didn't shake you up that much, didn't bother you, make you question what you were doing or alter your resolve or focus at all. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
How is that possible? How does that not get to you when you get hit in the helmet and you've got a big old hole in a helmet that says you could have been killed?
But I wasn't, so continue on.
Do you have, I'm sure over the years you've thought about that a time or two. I know you don't like to dwell on things, but how do you account for that? The fact that you survived that mission and that whether it was an inch that made a difference or whatever, that your life was not taken that day?
Well, I've always believed in the Supreme Being, and I think he was looking out for me.
I think that's a very strong possibility, and I don't think our audience would argue with you one bit. And apparently he was looking out for you for another 23 missions. I want to ask you about some missions in July of 1944. People that know what happened once the Normandy invasion began, a significant event happened in later July, the breakout from St. Lo, where the Germans had a stronghold, and when the American and Allied forces broke through there, it really changed that part of the war. But there were some casualties. There were some unfortunate events, and you have a connection to that. Those missions that you flew on July 24th and July 25th, and what you've been able to piece together since then. Tell me what that means to you today.
Well, it means that there was poor communication between the ground force and the air force because we were supposed to bomb this area. It was supposed to be where the Germans were, and the Americans had pulled back so the Germans would be there. Well, the Germans went back farther, and the Americans went in there to push them back, and that's when we arrived. Nobody told us that the Americans had gone back in to push the Germans back, so we dropped the bombs and killed our own troops, which very terrible, but I guess that's war.
And on that mission, you were the navigator of the lead plane in your formation?
We were the lead group, yeah.
And you found out later that Americans had been killed, including General McNair, who
Correct.
Had some notoriety at the time. Do you remember getting that news and what it did to you? Because you've talked about how you were successfully able to kind of keep things out of mind and just do your job and not get too emotional about it. When that happened, did that change? Did it make you a little more emotional than you had been?
Well, yeah, it felt real bad that killed our own buddies. It was, but there was nothing that could be done. It was too late. It had already been done. And it just makes you wonder why they can't communicate. Why there is a lot of secrecy goes on. Everybody thinks somebody's listening in on them, and if they hear anything, what are they going to do with it anyhow?
Well, and that's just part of the ugly side of war, that you know that there are going to be casualties, there's going to be collateral damage, and in many times friendly fire. It still happens today, and it happened back in World War II, and there's really nothing you can do about it. But General Leslie McNair was one of the casualties of those missions in July of 1944. Let's talk about a happier mission, because you get to the end of August in 1944. And here you are, 21 years old. You've already flown 32 missions in a war where your plane's getting shot up every day, where guys are dying, guys are being wounded, guys are being captured and held prisoner, and you've avoided all of that. And you find out that your mission to Gelsenkirchen on August 26th of 44 is going to be your 33rd and final mission. Do you have a little more excitement going into that mission?
Well, I knew it was going to be the last one, but I was unhappy to hear it was Gelsenkirchen, because that was in the Ruhr Valley. That's where all their heavy manufacturing was, and that's where all the heavy armament was, and knew that they were going to be shooting like mad, but luckily made it through that one too. So,
because I'm sure it sounds like the thought entered your mind, I really don't want to go down on my final mission.
Correct.
And you didn't. Now, we talked about your closest call on that mission to Berlin in June of 44. You also mentioned there were missions where you had to come back with only one of your four engines functioning and barely made it in. Were there any other moments that felt like you came this close to not making it home and you felt really thankful for surviving?
Well, there was another mission when we went to Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the props blew off and came through the plane and took the heel off the engineer's boot.
Mm.
But he was behind me. It wasn't close to me at all, but that shakes you up when you figure that prop. how it come off, nobody will ever know. But it sliced right on through and took the heel off his boot. And well, leaves a nice gash in the plane.
Yeah, so, sounds like it could have done a lot more damage.
Could have.
That gets your attention for sure. Did they make you an offer to stay in and fly some more missions?
Yes, they did. They offered me a promotion, which I really didn't care about. When I flew with my crew, and then I flew about four times whenever the base commander, the colonel, flew, I'd fly with him.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't interested because everybody seemed to know when the colonel's flying, they're all out to get him, the Germans, out to get the high brass, and I wasn't interested at all. They could have made me a general, and I didn't care. I was coming home.
If they can hit you in the helmet when you're not the target, you don't want to find out what it's like when you are the target, I guess. And so you did come home. And what was that like? Do you remember seeing American soil again and what that meant to you?
Yeah, we flew back and landed in Presque Isle, Maine. They took us into Boston by bus, and there were six of us. And that was really something different. I'd never seen that part of the country to start with, but it was nice.
And what, did you ride the train all the way back to Denver?
Rode the train back to Denver. Rode the train everywhere because the Air Force has some real weird rules. I was then went to Santa Monica for reassignment, and they ask you, where would you like to be stationed? I said, well, California. My mother lives out here, and everything. No problem. We got all these air bases in California. So 4 days later, the orders come out, and I am sent to Boca Raton, Florida, which is exactly right on the beach. And so instead of flying me in a training mission over there, I got a ticket from Los Angeles to Chicago, across to New Jersey, and straight down the East Coast. They bought me the ticket and then paid me 6 cents a mile to go.
Wow.
And which was pretty good, you know.
I'd take that deal, yeah.
Yeah. So I got there, and they finally did send me through pilot training, because when the war did end, I was flying B-25s out of Pampa, Texas.
And what was that like for you? Because here you had that ambition. You've got your perfect score on your pilot training test, but they say, we need you as a navigator. You go over, you do all your missions, you come back, and they finally let you fly the plane. Was that a big rush for you?
Oh, yeah, I really, that's what I always wanted. And that there were 102 of us officers that they were going to put through pilot training.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went through a program which was different than the regular program. We went through primary training. We skipped basic training, and we went directly into advanced training. Then after advanced training, we got to pick whether we wanted to go into single-engine P-51s out of Arizona or B-25s. Well, there were 10 of us wanted to go into the P-51s, and the rest wanted to go with the multi-engine. So the 10 of us go to Pampa, Texas for B-25s, and all the rest go to P-51 school.
They kept getting their signals crossed, huh?
Yeah, but I enjoyed that B-25. It was a great airplane, a really great airplane. You can't hurt it. You could do all kinds of real neat stuff in it.
So how long did you do that before you got out of the service?
I flew about 3 months
mm-hmm.
as a flying B-25s.
And then you decided it was time to go back to school?
Then the war ended, and you had a choice, to stay in the post-war Air Force or resign your commission. So I resigned my commission.
Are you glad you made that choice?
Yes.
Otherwise, you might have been flying in Korea.
Absolutely.
And you'd had enough of putting yourself in harm's way, I'm sure. So you, and do you have any strong memories about the end of the war and how that news hit you where you were at the time?
Well, at the time, like I say, was in Pampa, Texas, and there were two of us flying in formation. I used to fly those B-25 solo,
mm-hmm.
and we were flying in formation, and we had a real good time buzzing all the highways in Texas.
To celebrate.
Yeah, because we knew we were going to go home and get out.
So this might be your last chance to fly this big equipment.
Right.
Yeah.
It was the last chance. It was our last flight. But it was really nice to hear that it was over. It was all gone.
Now, how many tricks can you really do in a B-25? When you say you were doing tricks and buzzing people.
Oh, you could do loops.
Mm-hmm.
The colonel used to get so mad. They used to teach you short field takeoff.
Right.
But then if you did one, they all got mad. Well, why teach it if you don't want to do it?
And you knew it worked for Doolittle.
Yeah, it worked for. That's why they taught it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't good for the plane.
Where you said that was a wise decision to get out at that point at the end of the war. Were there ever some times where you regretted it and wished you were still flying those planes?
I really would have enjoyed flying, but I didn't want to be in the service anymore. No, didn't want to be in the service any longer.
You decided to do your flying on the racetrack again at the University of Colorado. You went back to school after the war and were on the track team again running the 880. How different was that for you? Did you notice a difference in yourself having been through everything you went through in your time in the service?
Not really, because I was still young.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young like that, nothing really seems to bother you. You notice things when you get older.
You don't seem like you believe in getting old, though.
Well, my mother made it to 101.
You're trying to beat her?
Yeah.
You seem like a competitive guy. I could see that. And
my biggest joy in life was, and still is, play golf with young kids and beat them.
Mm-hmm. And shooting your age probably isn't bad either.
I did that when I was 72.
Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling you're going to do it again. If you shot a 90 the other day and you're 88, then I think it's right around the corner. I guess you've probably already answered this question. How long do you plan on continuing to go out there to the golf course and hit the ball around?
Well, I go twice a week, and I'll go as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you're very competitive with that, and you just described some of that. Tell me about this day where you hit a hole-in-one and bowled a 300 game in the same day.
Yeah, and my good friend Ferris from the Fresno Bee.
Bruce Ferris. I talked to him earlier today, yep.
Yeah, he put a nice article in the Bee with my picture and everything and said, great achiever.
What'd you have for breakfast that day? How'd you pull that off?
Breakfast of champions. Who knows? It's hard to remember what I had for breakfast yesterday.
Do you think the fact that you had already hit a hole-in-one that day helped you bowl a 300 game later?
No.
Didn't give you the confidence to pull it off?
No, it's entirely different. A hole-in-one is one shot.
Yeah.
Where a 300 game, you got to get 12.
Mm-hmm. You got to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in high school, North Denver High, the school played football. I was quarterback, weighed a whole 135 pounds. But the school had over 4,000 students, and we had one student that weighed 200 pounds. Mm. They didn't have fat kids in those days. Mm-hmm. They were unheard of. And that's at the time when you played football, you played offense, you played defense. If you came out, you couldn't go back that quarter. You had to wait for the start of the next quarter.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a junior, played 11 games, we went unbeaten, untied, and unscored upon.
Wow. Perfect records are no stranger to you.
No.
And that counts with your 33 missions as well. I've got to ask, I'm sure there are a lot of people listening that hear this and they're saying, man, I'd like to hit one hole-in-one, let alone six. I'd like to come close to bowling a 300 game. Hey, I'd even take 200. What's the secret? What is it about? Is it your competitive spirit? Is it a focus that you have? How do you think you've been able to accomplish those things that so many of us could never dream of accomplishing?
It's terrible to say, but you got to have an ego that figures, if someone else did it, I should be able to do it.
Uh-huh.
If you look at it that way, because if you figure, oh, I can't do it, well, you're not going to do it, then why can't you do it?
Mm-hmm.
You got a club, same ball, club, same club. Why can't you hit that ball in the hole? It's just you got to have faith in yourself.
Sounds like you're planning on your seventh hole-in-one happening one of these days.
Yeah, I am.
I believe it. We're just about out of time, but is there anything else that you want to share with us about your time in World War II, the guys you served with, or why you guys were all over there to begin with, what we need to remember about that here today?
That incident, it stemmed from the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and the Japanese took a lot of grief for it, but I have some extremely good friends that are Japanese, and they were dead set against it as much as we were,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them really bore the brunt of ill will just because of the fact. But I got some real good friends that are Japanese that they were pushed into the internment camps and all, which I guess it was the public would probably have lynched him if they hadn't, but it's not anything that should be proud of.
Do you think it's important that future generations of Americans know about this stuff, know what you and all the guys like you did in 65 years ago?
Yes, they should. They should.
If you could say what you're most proud of, I know you're not done yet. I know you're still going for a hole-in-one number 7 and some more accomplishments. You're only 88 and your mom went to 101. But if there's one thing you're most proud of, what would you say that is?
That I was able to do a little good for my country during the war, because I firmly believe this is the greatest place to be. It makes me sick as to what's happening now. We got a bunch of, I call them morons. It's a simple term for legislators. But they're not interested in the country. All they're interested in is their party. And I don't want to get into politics because this isn't the time.
Well, I think everyone understands what you're saying. And Mike, I just want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling me a little bit about it. Well, that's our program for today. Mike Lombardi, 88 years old of Fresno, California, has been our guest. To see what he looks like, see that special helmet of his, and read more about the 381st Bomb Group, go to our website, kmjnow.com, or dial up Hometown Heroes on Facebook. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.